Morning, everyone. About 7 or 8 years ago, I was requested to write a little article. You know, we have to write articles from time to time for Purvodhabharata and Vedanta Keshari on Lila Chintana, the reflection or contemplation on the divine play. So at that time, as I sometimes do, if I have to write something, then I'll try it out first on the audience. I came up with this talk. Maybe some of you remember. I actually gave it in Belarmut. And for some reason, they kept it on their website forever. It may still even be there. But it is a fascinating topic. It's actually also one of my favorite topics and very, very practical in terms of our own spiritual life and our spiritual practice. To me, this is one of the easiest and most effective and most joyful practices that we have, this reflection and meditation on the divine sport, Lila. So the Lila Chintana, Lila Dhyana, these two things I want to speak about this morning. So we'll go through first Lila, what we mean by this term Lila. Then we'll go through what we mean by the term Dhyana, meditation, and then Chintana, reflection or contemplation. Of course, Thakur uses Lila in a very special sense. For him, he always talks about Nitya and Lila. He puts these two together. This is the terminology he uses for what, at least in the English translation, is the absolute, Nitya the absolute, and Lila the relative. Literally, it'll be Nitya, of course, will be the eternal aspect. And Lila, very often, will use this word play or sport. And it has specific reference to the divine play of the avatar, especially Krishna and Rama, and of those two, even more so Krishna, with all of the stages of his life, from his childhood to when he becomes the cowherd boy and when he goes to Mathura and Dwarka, all of the different stages of his life. So we see this one meaning there is this idea of a sport or a play or a pastime, some type of diversion or some type of amusement. Then, Lila also carries this meaning of something that's easily done. Lilaya, they'll say. It'll be done just effortlessly, something like that. Child's play, we can say mere child's play. Then, it has the implication of something not entirely real. If we go to a movie or we go to a play, we get very involved in the whole thing. People are shooting each other, maybe killing each other, all sorts of things. And then when we leave, we forget it. It was just a play. It was just a movie. It wasn't actually real. At the time, it's very real. But afterwards, we say it's not so real. So we have all of these different levels of meaning or aspects of this term, Lila. Then we'll find also that the term is used in different contexts with different types of manifestation. Sri Ramakrishna will talk about different types of lila. He will talk about this lila of the divine Lord, lila with the gods and goddesses, with this human birth, with all sorts of different things, because this was really one of his favorite ideas, this idea of lila. See, we have many different ways of explaining how this whole universe comes into existence. We have very high philosophical ideas about the Maya and manifestation and everything. But at the end, we don't really know. Maya means we don't really understand. But one way is to simply say, this is a divine Lila. This is a play. That God's play, and we don't analyze it too much. But so this is one of the ideas. Anyhow, Sri Ramakrishna was having a conversation with the devotees. This was February 24th, 1884. And he said to M, since my arm was injured, now we know Thakur was walking along the pathway, and suddenly his mind got thrown into some divine mood, and he had some vision of Jagannath, and he went to embrace and fell down and broke his arm. So this took place when he was in some ecstatic state. His mind was someplace else. So he said, since my arm was injured, a deep change has come over me. I now delight only in the Nada Lila. So this is one type of Lila, the human manifestation of God. Nitya and Lila, the Nityas, the indivisible Satchidananda, and the Leela or sport takes various forms, such as the Leela of God. So we have Bhagavan, we have all these different ideas, Shiva and Parvati sitting and playing games and talking to each other, all sorts of things going on. The Leela as the deities, the Leela as man, and the Leela as the universe. Vaishnav Charan was a very dear friend of Sri Ramakrishna, a kind of leader of one of the communities at that time, used to say that one has attained perfect knowledge if one believes in God sporting as man. I wouldn't admit it then, but now I realize that he was right. It is God alone who is sporting as man. So we see all of these different types of manifestations, Brahman manifesting as the personal God. This is one type of Leela, as the different gods and goddesses, deities, another type. This whole visible universe is also the play of God. This is a type of Leela, all living beings. This is also a type, a kind of play, not real in any absolute sense, to us, of course, very real. Very real now. When it's all over, we look back on it, we wonder, how real was it? Everything at the end of life looks a little bit like a long dream. So it has that kind of sense to it. So just for fun, why would God create a universe? No reason. There's nothing to be gained. God doesn't have any desires that need to be fulfilled, nothing. So we have all these very interesting ideas, even in Upanishads, that he got bored. He looked around. He didn't see anybody. What can I do? Let me create something. And then let me enter into everything and let this whole fun and game begin. Of course, it's not much fun most of the time. And Swami Vivekananda says in one place, it's like puppies. You see puppies play. We used to have foxes. They would come out here. I would watch them, these little baby foxes. They would nip and bite and everything and make funny noises and run away. But it was all fun for them. It was all play. To us, it looks like, oh, they may hurt each other or something. But so Swamiji says, like puppies playing with each other and nipping and biting at each other, but it's all play. Now, it takes a very high point of view for us to understand that. To us, of course, when people are suffering, it's not much fun. But anyhow, this is that idea of Leela. Now, I want to focus on this Nara Leela, this divine sport in human form, God sporting in human form. Now, we have two ways of looking at this. One is from this high philosophical point of view, or Advaita Vedanta will say that God is manifest equally in all beings. And Sri Ramakrishna had that vision. When he would look out, if he stood here and saw this whole audience, he would say that I don't see this person, that person. I would see that God himself manifests as all living beings. So this is one idea of Nara Leela, that this Brahman enters into this whole creation and forgets his real nature. And this is a big play, is each and every one of us trying to remember that we're that same Brahman. And then at the end of it, we realize there wasn't any each and every one of us, only Brahman manifesting as the whole thing. The second sense, which is what we're going to talk about more this morning, is with this idea of the avatar, the divine incarnation. This is a special manifestation of God in human form. And Sri Ramakrishna, when he speaks of this Nara Leela, most of the time he'll be talking about this. And this is what we mean when we talk about this reflection and meditation on this Nara Leela aspect. We're talking about these very rare great souls that take birth from time to time, and the immense benefit that comes to us by even thinking about them, remembering them, and meditating on them. So this is that Nara Leela. This, of course, is something that is very, very popular, not just in India. In India, of course, especially among the Vaishnava traditions, but we have this in Christianity also. If you really think about Christianity, most of it, and the Bible study and everything, is reflecting on each and every step and every word that Christ took and said when he was living at that time. that divine play of the Son of God and his relationship with the Father. So we see it in many traditions, especially the Vaishnava tradition, as I said, with Krishna and the gopis. And we'll see this relationship between Radha, especially, and Krishna is a very nice blueprint for us when we try to think how we can engage in this type of lila, dhyana, lila, chintana. The divine lila with Krishna is especially appropriate because he engaged in play himself. He was very playful as a young boy, and even older, how he would steal the clothes of the gopis, and he would hide things from his mother and eat the butter and all sorts of things. So we have this whole thing in each stage of his life with this idea of playfulness and sportiveness. There's a whole thing. And we'll see the same thing, of course, in the life of Sri Ramakrishna. It's very interesting to compare this divine lila of Krishna with the divine lila of Sri Ramakrishna, because there are many very nice parallels that way. Now, one thing with lila, this lila of the avatar, when we look back on what took place during the lifetime, we see that everything seems to be a little bit staged, pre-planned. Everyone has his role to play. Everyone has his place. We can't imagine this lila of Sri Ramakrishna without Holy Mother, without Narendra and Rakhal, and of course without M there to record everything. So they all had their role to play in this whole thing. We know once that Tarakta, Swami Shivananda, he wanted to write down Thakur's words. Thakur said, that's not for you. He has that role. That's not your, as if he knew, and they all knew that each one had something very special that they had to do, a special part in this play, like a drama. Everyone has their role to play in that. Now, one thing I want to mention, though, is this type of reflection and meditation on this Naralila aspect doesn't require us to accept this idea of the avatar. We had a long discussion about this Friday night at our class. Some people may say, I don't really believe in this divine incarnation thing. Doesn't matter. And the best example we have is the whole Buddhist tradition, where they'll also spend, of course, they have their own type of meditation and everything, but they'll also spend a great deal of time contemplating this divine play of Buddha, his great renunciation, his years of austerity, his nirvana, all of the different aspects of his life, his sermons and all of that. So all we need to do is recognize that there's a very special soul that was born in a special circumstances with tremendous spiritual power, and it's tremendously beneficial to us even to think about them. We need at least that much faith, that just thinking about them has a transformative power, that it can change our lives. As I said, it's a very strong, effective type of spiritual practice. Now, meditation. We're all familiar with meditation as a yogic practice. And this is mostly what we read about Raja Yoga, what we study, that we're trying to focus the mind on a single point. When the mind wanders away, then we bring it back. This is Abhyasa Yoga. So that ultimately we want to merge the mind in one single point so that it, in essence, disappears or becomes one with the object of meditation, with Brahman, and then we go into higher states of samadhi and all of that. Now, this is very effective for those who have a very, very sharp intellect, and for those who don't have a lot of things to worry about and a lot of things dangling in front of them that they're attracted to. A lot of desires and things like that. This one-pointedness is this ekagrata. This is the key to this type of meditation. Sri Ramakrishna gives a very nice illustration of what it really means to be one-pointed. He's talking about practice of archery when Arjuna was given instruction in archery by Drona. Dronacharya, he was the one who taught them all archery. He wanted him to shoot a bird, flying bird, with his arrow. So he said to him, "What do you see?" And everyone was all there around. He said, "Do you see these kings?" He said, "No, sir." He said, "Do you see me?" He said, "No." "Do you see the trees?" "No." "Do you see the bird on the tree?" He's trying to shoot the bird. So he says, "No." "What do you see then?" He said, "Only the eye of the bird." So that fine one-pointedness. Now, the difficulty with this is that when the mind wanders, if it's such a fine thing, when the mind wanders a little bit, it completely gets off track. This is the main problem. If we lose sight of the eye of the bird, we may lose the whole bird itself. And then God knows where the mind is. This is the main problem, that for most of us, it's a little too tight. We don't give ourselves room for the mind to wander about a little bit. So what happens very often is that the mind rebels a little bit. Maybe it doesn't tell us that it's rebelling, but it gets bored. Mind gets bored, doesn't like to remain quiet. It likes a little variety. So it goes here and there. It runs around a little bit. And as I say, when it loses contact with that object, that fine object of meditation, then it can lose the whole thing. So this is the basic problem that we have here. If our concentration is only on the eye of the bird, then when we lose that, we lose the bird, we lose everything else. So this is why this type of meditation on the divine play of an avatar, of a divine incarnation of God, or a realized soul, or a great saint, it can be anyone that represents a very high ideal for us, is a great help to us because it expands that circle. It allows us to keep the mind focused on a theme, on an idea, as opposed to a very single tiny point. So it allows us to have our object of meditation as a multifaceted, like a gem. We can think of all different aspects of the object of our meditation. So we find that this tendency of the mind to wander a little bit, rather than being a negative, becomes a positive. We want the mind to wander. We allow the mind to wander within a circle. And we know the very common illustration that when you take a cow, you put him to the pasture to graze, you put a rope on him, you tether him, and you take a post and you knock it into the ground, and then the cow can wander all around within the circumference of the circle that's created by that radius of the rope. So this is what we're doing. We're giving ourselves a big enough circle so that there's no danger of us going outside of the circle. We stay within that circle, which all relates to the same divine theme, this Lila Dhyana. So suppose we want to fix our minds on the image of Sri Ramakrishna, and we're taught that we meditate within the cave of the heart, within the heart center, then with this type of meditation, we can picture Sri Ramakrishna sitting in his room. He's sitting on his cot. How do we enter into meditation? We walk through the door, right? We walk through the door. We see him facing. We bow down to him. We sit before him. We look around the room. See, we're allowed to wander a little. We're curious who else is in the room. Narendra is sitting there. Rakhal is sitting there. Tarukta, Babu Ramda, all of them, the direct disciples are there. Emma's in the corner. We can see that he's taking down everything mentally like that. We see all the pictures on the wall. We see the big jug there, and we remember, oh, that's where Thakur sat just next to that when he worshipped Holy Mother, Shodashi Puja. We can do all of these things within this type of meditation. So Thakur doesn't have to keep sitting. We can see him stand up. He can go around. He used to clap his hands in the morning, go in front of all the pictures and sing and recite all of the names and do all of that. Then someone else would sing and he would start singing, dancing. They would form a circle. They would dance around him. Then he would go into ecstasy. Baburam would have to hold him up and they would carefully put him down. All of these things we can think about in this type of meditation. This is exactly what Sri Ramakrishna means by Vidya Maya. It's Maya, it's imagination. We're using our imagination, but in a very helpful way. In a very helpful way, because it's at the same time, it's doing two things. One, it's keeping the mind fixed on this divine play, and two, it's keeping the mind from wandering. After we finish this meditation, we think, oh, where was I? I completely forgot about everything else. I forgot about job, family, friends, everything, that I was transported to a new realm. So this is what we do with this type of meditation. We can picture anything. We can go through the whole scene of Thakur worshiping Holy Mother Shodasi Puja. We can see him going out of the room, Panchavati having a picnic with all of the others. We can do whatever we like with this type. We can get bored with Thakur and say, let me go and sit with Holy Mother and watch through the screen what's going on there. We can go to Udbodhan. We can do anything we like. So this is the nice thing. It gives us a tremendous freedom, this type of meditation. So it's really endless. It's limited only by our imagination. There was a disciple of Holy Mother named Swami Premeshananda. I mention him very often because we have a very close connection through Swami Swanandaji, and I had the good fortune of working on his letters, the book of letters, which we have here both in the English and in the original Bengali. He loved this idea. He loved this idea of meditating on this divine play. And he often spoke about it as really going to a certain place. See, he has this one song. What is it called? Kamar Pukore Chole Mon. Yeah. Oh, my mind, let us go to Kamar Pukore. As if we're really going there. And he wrote so many beautiful things about the different types of divine play that we can meditate on. I want to just read a couple of things. And he also liked this idea that we find in the worship of Sri Krishna, that he liked to think of Thakur as a young boy also. We don't generally we try to meditate on Thakur. We picture him during his Dakshineshwar years. But he liked this other idea. So one of the letters that he wrote, he said, I forget who he wrote this to, but he's telling him all different ways to think of Thakur in meditation or contemplation. So he says, many beautiful boys are playing on a summer afternoon in the mango grove of Kumar Pukur. The whole area has been bathed by the rains of the monsoon season. It is a Sunday evening and everything is sparkling. All around are open meadows. Above lies the clear blue sky. And in between, a breeze is blowing, tussling the hair of the boys and drying the beads of perspiration on their sweet faces. He was a tremendous writer also. And many of the songs that you hear that are sung were composed by him. The boys create varieties of pretexts for touching Godai. Godai was Ramakrishna's childhood name. As if their hearts were all radii centered on him alone. Godai's eyes have a very calm, kind, and soul-piercing look to them. If but once one gazes into them, a beautiful impression seems to be imprinted on his heart. His lips are reddish like two petals of a flower, his small teeth like white jasmine blossoms. His chest is broad, his arms long, his fingers more beautiful than magnolia buds. As soon as the boys see him, they want to make him their own. Once they get him, they immediately become friends and are unwilling to let him go. The sound of Godai's voice is like honey, and all his movements manifest sweetness. He enchants his playmates each day with new games. And what can I say about the songs that flow from his sweet voice? If one hears his songs only once, the desire to hear those of anyone else completely vanishes. The spiritual seeker takes great pleasure in seeing the lovely form of the boys, their joy and enthusiasm, especially for that one boy. So he comes a bit closer and sees that the toes on Godai's fair feet are like lotus petals resting on green blades of grass bathed by the rain. Beholding these two feet, he is unable to turn his eyes away. Looking at them with a fixed gaze, he forgets the outer world and simply remains immersed in the ocean-like beauty of those feet. When hearing the soft laughter of the boys, he regains his awareness of the outer world. He sees that red, blue, and white lotuses seem to have blossomed in a lake. In their midst is Godai. the 100-petaled lotus, and the joyous faces of the pure boys who are his companions. The seeker remains enchanted by his divine image. The only thought that comes to his mind is, may I behold this bewitching form at all times. With firm resolve, he tries to picture this scene, just as one sees various scenes in a dream. Gradually, his mind becomes immersed in the ocean of meditation. Then he experiences greater and greater joy and becomes merged in the ocean of bliss. There's another interesting thing. I was saying how we're only limited by our imagination. He had a fantastic imagination. So he wrote to someone, Swami Premeshananda, there is a new game, table tennis. He had never seen table tennis before. Table tennis, which is really quite fascinating. If you sit quietly just playing, the game will naturally fill your mind. So when sitting for your daily devotions, first spend a little time letting your mind roam about every corner of the Dakshineswar Kali temple, or mentally wander through Bellarmut and circumambulate the temple. If you do this for some time, your mind will run toward Thakur. There is no limit to Thakur's lila. One can spend a lot of time just thinking about his divine sport. If your mind does not become calm even through this, then enter Thakur's room at Dakshineswar. Set up the table there and play the game with Thakur, Narendra, Rakhal, Vishuddhananda, Premeshananda, and other members of the family. Now, we can see that there are many advantages to this kind of meditation. First of all, it's very joyful. And second of all, it's much easier. The other is chewing stones. There's other type of meditation, very, very difficult. And it allows us to use this very active imagination that most of us have. So the imagination becomes our friend, becomes our ally in this type of meditation. And so the same tendency of the mind that gets us into trouble is the one that we utilize. So a tremendous advantage to that. We find with this type of meditation that we don't need that great control over the mind that we need with the type of yogic meditation. And this counteracts automatically that feeling of boredom, that restlessness of mind, all of the other things that we saw are obstacles to meditation. But there's a very interesting twist to this whole thing, that we do this type of meditation partly because we're incapable of keeping the mind fixed at one point. But through this type of meditation, we find that our concentration actually gets stronger. And there'll come a time when we've seen Thakur sing and dance enough, let him go into samadhi, let him sit on his cot, and let us sit facing him, and he'll be unmoving, we'll be unmoving. And then that'll be the same thing we tried to do, wanted to do in the beginning, but couldn't do. So this is a way of allowing ourselves to focus on the eye of the bird by starting out with the whole scene and making it narrower and narrower until we get to the very point of our meditation. So tremendous fruits to this type of meditation. We feel tremendous joy. We feel that we're face to face with our Ishta Devata. Whatever our conception of God is, however we like to worship God, we feel that we're face to face. So Thakur is sitting there in front of us, and we're in the company. We have the tremendous holy company with all of the other devotees there. And this relationship that we form becomes a very real type of relationship. Now, one thing that we find also, if we're placing Thakur within the heart, through this power of imagination, we're also imagining ourselves there, right? We have to pick, many people ask, many people say, oh, we're taught in meditation that the Ishta Devata dwells within the heart, and yet we're supposed to be face to face in our meditation. How do we do it? If I'm here looking that way, and what do we do? We have to imagine ourselves also in the heart center. Now, if we do that, then at the end of this meditation, we realize that we cease to identify with this physical body. We've identified with this almost like a dreamlike body, with this meditation body. So Thakur talks about this Chinmay Sham, Chinmay Dham. So the object of meditation is pure consciousness. It's taking place within the mind. Within the heart center means within the mind. We ourselves exist within the mind. The whole setting is within the mind. So at the end of this meditation, we see that our identification with this physical body also becomes less. This is one of the great advantages to this type of meditation. We forge that relationship, and we lessen this identification with this physical body. And then we see that everything exists within consciousness. This divine play in meditation takes place within the realm of consciousness that we enter into when we enter to that state of meditation. The other advantage to this is we're meditating not simply on this divine play. Of course, it's part of the divine play, but also we can't think of a person without thinking of the attributes and qualities and characteristics. So we can't think of Sri Ramakrishna without thinking of his tremendous love, his compassion, his devotion, his renunciation, all of these things. And we know that there's a process of transference that takes place, that the deeper we think about something, the more we acquire that. And Sri Ramakrishna used to say that. He used to say that just as the son inherits the riches of the father, so by meditating on him or any divine figure, we'll also attain, we'll get those same riches. In this case, spiritual treasures. We'll get that. So this transformation takes place this way, where that little bit of that purity, a little bit of that tremendous devotion will come to us as well. The final thing, which will take us to the idea of contemplation, the final great advantage to this meditation is the carryover factor. When we leave our meditation seat after this, we find that part of the mind remains back. It doesn't want to leave. So we have to get up, we have to go to the work, whatever we have to do, but the mind says, oh, I want to stay in Thakur's room. I'm not ready to leave yet. Let the mind, so the mind will stay there. Really, when we talk about where we are, where we live, all of that, is all where the mind is. Right? So if we're thinking of Thakur, we're picturing him sitting in his room, that's where we are also. So part of the mind remains there. So we have this tremendous carryover effect, so that we start to feel also that that divine scene that we imagine somehow still exists. This is another very important thing, that we have the feeling that if we could only now go to Dakshineshwar, we would see Thakur sitting there, that somehow it's a divine play. We have our Nitya Lila, we can combine them. This is a Nitya Lila. So this is that divine play is going on all of the time. All we have to do is think about it. All we have to do is remember it, and it's always available to us. So we start to get that feeling that we live in two different realms. We live in this physical realm, and we live in this other. You can say that it's a little bit of paglami, little madness, that we're here, but the mind is someplace else. But it's okay, it's a good type of madness. Okay, now we get to this third aspect, this lila chintana, contemplation, reflection on the divine sport. So, we saw that through our meditation that we get a kind of natural remembrance through this carryover effect. Afterwards, the mind wants to dwell. The mind doesn't easily switch gears. The mind will remain that way. So, meditation itself helps us in reflection, but reflection helps us with meditation. It has to reinforce. They both work hand in hand. If we want to be able to fix the mind easily in meditation on this divine play, we have to think about it during our waking hours. Part of the mind should be there all of the time, and If we can do that, usually we'll go into it in meditation, and then the carryover effect will be there. So they work hand in hand. They help each other. Because meditation, how long can we do it? We can do it a little in the morning, a little in the evening, maybe. This other practice we can do all the time. In the midst of our work, we can still feel, yes, that divine play is going on. So Sri Ramakrishna very often would say that the most important spiritual practice, Sharan Manan, this constant remembrance and reflection of this divine play, that will help us in our meditation as well. So they work together. These are the two things that really go hand in hand in spiritual practice. Now, there are different ways that we can facilitate this divine reflection, divine contemplation. The first is spiritual reading. And specifically, we can say this Kathamrita, the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, or Mayakatha, the Gospel of Holy Mother, and any of these types of literature that paint a picture for us, give us something to visualize, the Eternal Companion, any of these where we read them and we're somehow picturing these divine souls either as they're acting or as they're speaking. And this again we see in Christianity, this tremendous devotion to study of the Bible, which is all the words and actions of Christ, or again in Vaishnava tradition, a tremendous devotion to Bhagavata Purana, with all of the episodes of Krishna from his childhood onward. So it's a tremendous practice for us, and for me especially, this Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna is the most important thing. If we give up our meditation, we give up our prayer, our job, we give up everything else, but at least cling to that. We do some reading from the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna every day, then we won't lose that spiritual hold that we have. That'll be our tie. That'll be our holy company. That'll be our meditation. That'll be everything for us. So the more we immerse ourselves in this type of literature, the better it is for us. When I first read the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, I liked it, but I didn't quite get it. It was a little... I wasn't quite sure how M knew what people were thinking and everything. Later I found out it was him who was thinking everything. But the second time I read it, then it really got to me. Then I read it over and over and over. And I went through different periods where I would spend hours reading it. I never got tired of it. This is the one book that you constantly find new things in. So tremendous. This M, we owe M a debt of gratitude that can never be repaid for composing this Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. Now, different ways of reading it, of course. Some people will like to read a few pages and then meditate, and meditate on that particular episode or teaching that we have there, and picture ourselves as being present at that time. So we can listen, read about Thakur talking to Keshav and Vijay on the steamer and picture ourselves on the steamer, all different ways that it can be done. Or we can read it whenever we have a chance. Some people carry these books with them. Whenever they get an opportunity, they'll read some. But it's nice to have a fixed time for all of these things. They have a fixed time. Since I first read it, I try to read a little bit every night before I go to sleep. Now we're reading the Bengali in the mornings also, so we get to do it twice a day. So just this one practice, we find that it brings a certain type of joy, and this mundane aspect of life really gets mitigated to a great extent. Because any time we can just think, if I could go, back there again. So it's a very wonderful type of practice. Now the second, so this is a spiritual reading. Second is pilgrimage. And pilgrimage in particular will mean going there, go to the scene of these places. Go to Dakshineswar, go to Kamarpakur, Jayadambati, of course, Balarmad a little bit later, but all of these places. I had the tremendous advantage of going to these places very early in my life, before I knew anything. I knew who Thakur was, and I had read a little bit, but before I read the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, I went there. Now, for those in India, that's not so unusual. For those in the West, it's very unusual. Usually we get immersed in the whole tradition, and then we have some curiosity to go. I did it the other way, so that when I started reading the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, I knew exactly what it meant, that he's facing north. I could picture it. The Ganges is flowing to the west. I could picture all of these things. So to go to these places is very, very important. We saw Swami Parameshananda, but M also encouraged his devotees and all of those that came to him very, very strongly to go to Dakshineshwar and picture what took place in each and every place. Don't go as a tourist, he said. Go to Dakshineshwar and this walk around. This is where Thakur performed this sadhana. This is where this happened. The Bhairavi Brahmani came through this door. And picture all of these things. Etch them into your heart. So when you sit for meditation, these scenes will come back. So to actually go to these places is a very, very important type of spiritual practice. At least once, everyone should visit these places. When I was doing my graduate studies living in Philadelphia, I lived in a dumpy little apartment in West Philadelphia. I think it was $68 a month, a little. Swami Brahmarupananji was also in Philadelphia at that time. We knew each other from back then. But I developed this practice at that time of spending the evening in some type of spiritual practice. See, I read in the Gospel, Thakur said that Shondhabalai Shabkaj Chare Ishara Shoran Karbe. So as soon as the sun goes down, put all your work aside and devote your time to spiritual practice. So I didn't do any homework or anything. I would make sure I finished everything before. So then as soon as it became time for evening prayer, sitting alone in that apartment, I would sing all of the arati songs. Then I would sit for meditation. Then I would read the Gospel, sometimes an hour. And I had the small one. So I went through it over and over and over again till I got the big one. And I went through it so many times that I discovered a very interesting thing. As soon as I would close my eyes for meditation, this dumpy little apartment in Philadelphia would be transformed into Thakur's room. So that I really felt when I would open my eyes, I would be surprised that I was back in Philadelphia. It would get transformed just through this process of immersing the mind through the reading and through remembrance of actually going there of the places associated with Sri Ramakrishna. So it's a very, very powerful, powerful type of spiritual practice. And of course, whenever I go back to India, I make a point of going to Sri Ramakrishna's room, especially that there's something magical. You cross the threshold of that room and you enter into a different space. I don't believe that that room exists on the earth. You enter into a different world. Just let the mind imagine what took place in that room over that period of 4 or 5 years. What took place when all of the direct disciples started coming to him and all the ecstasy and everything, and Holy Mother bringing the food and serving him. Yeah, it's overwhelming. So this is a very interesting type of spiritual practice, very, very different from other types of practice, which are very much current today. Now everything is in mindfulness, right? There was a very famous book that was written many, many years ago by this Baba Ramdas. He was an American professor at Harvard who was a contemporary of Timothy Leary, with the psychedelic drugs and all of that. Anyhow, he wrote a book called Be Here Now. And it was a very, very popular book with the idea that, no, we never live in the present because we're always picturing things in the future or imagining things in the past and desiring things. So we're never really living in the present. So it's a very nice idea, be here now. But this other philosophy is the exact opposite. Be there then. This is what we're trying to do. Forget about this idea. Yeah, it's nice. Okay, it's nice. We're told, don't let the mind run around. Be focused. Don't daydream. Live in the present. This is the exact, live in the past. Daydream. Let the mind wander. Let it be someplace else. What's so great about fixing the mind on the present? Really, if we're interested in that spiritual joy and that transformation that takes place, let us be a little crazy. Thakur loved that song, right? Amai de ma pagal kore. Mother, make me mad with love. So a little bit of madness is not such a bad thing. So be there then. So this is may not appeal to everyone, but a little bit of this type of practice is a very nice thing. And as I said before, we have this model for this with Radha and Krishna. And what is this period of contemplation? To me, this period of contemplation is the time when Radha was away from Krishna. She's stuck doing her household duties, and she can't sneak out of the house at that time. Whole mind is fixed on Govinda. Whole mind is fixed on this young boy who sits out and grazes the cows and plays his flute. Can't wait till she can get there. Now, when she gets there, this is the meditation. So really, we can develop this type of idea that every moment of the day, we're waiting till we can go back to Thakur's room. When do we go back? As soon as we sit for meditation. We enter into his room at that time, and we sit, we have his company. As soon as we leave, we can't wait to get back. This is a very nice statement that Swami Turiyananda, the Hari at that time, he said, we had such a joy in the presence of Sri Ramakrishna that as soon as we left, all we could think about was when will we go back again. That thinking, when will we go back again, remembering him and everything, this is that reflection on the divine play. Going back there, sitting in his room, being face to face with him, that's the meditation aspect, we can say of that. So, as I say, not everyone will like this. Some people, and people can get great joy out of it, soham yoga type of meditation and everything. But for those who have a little bit of that devotional side to them, this is a very nice type of meditation to do. So let us take a few minutes and use our imaginations. Picture some scene. Let them feel that you're there. This is a nice thing. Because we go there. This is mind travel. This is just, we really go there. And the whole play takes place within the heart, within our own innermost consciousness.
Jananiṁ śārādāṁ devīṁ Ramakrishnam jagadgurum pādapadme tayo śrutvā pranamāmi muhuramuhu.
We offer our loving pranams to Sri Ramakrishna, Holy Mother, all the direct disciples, and we take shelter at their lotus feet. Om Shanti, 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 peace, peace, peace be unto all.